2015 marks the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. We take note of that this hour with two stories set in different years of the war and in very different places. One in the frozen wilderness of Alaska, the other on the island of Okinawa. Washington Post reporter Brian Murphy tells the story of Leon Crane, a young aviator who bailed out of a crippled B-24 bomber in 1943 at the coldest, darkest point of the Alaskan winter, with nothing more than his winter clothing, a pocket knife, and two boxes of matches. Then we hear from Len Lazarick, longtime Maryland journalist whose father served in the infantry during the long and bloody Battle of Okinawa that ended 70 years ago this week. That's next on Midday after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. As promised, we offer two stories from World War II this hour. A bit later on, we note the 70th anniversary of the American conquest of the island of Okinawa, following the long and bloody battle that claimed thousands of American and Japanese military and civilian lives in the spring and summer of 1945. Len Lazarick, editor and publisher of MarylandReporter.com, will be joining us later in this hour. Len's father was in the infantry in Okinawa, and he cares very much that Americans know this history. He's visited Okinawa and written about the battle, which ended 70 years ago this week. Len Lazarick joins us in about 20 or 40, I'm sorry, about half an hour from now. We start the show with another story from World War II, but with a very different setting. Over three decades as a foreign correspondent, our first guest has written many stories of suffering and bravery in the face of hostile elements, but few as remarkable as the almost forgotten story of a young man from Philadelphia named Leon Crane. Leon Crane was in the co-pilot seat of a B-24 bomber on a test flight from Ladd Army Airfield near Fairbanks, Alaska, late in December of 1943. Although the fighting in Alaska's Aleutian Islands was over, the pilots who flew out of Ladd faced an enemy that could kill them as surely as a Japanese bullet and almost as quickly, temperatures that plunged 20 to 40 degrees below zero, accompanied by high winds and blinding snow, made the thin skin of an airplane the only barrier between its crew and almost certain death. So, when an engine failure and control malfunction sent Leon Crane's bomber into a spin so violent that the radio operator had no time to get off a Mayday signal, Leon Crane had only seconds to bail out before the plane crashed into the wilderness of the Yukon. Brian Murphy tells what happened to Leon Crane in 81 Days Below Zero, his third book. Brian has had a long and distinguished career as a foreign correspondent, covering stories from 40 countries over the years, first as a reporter and bureau chief for the Associated Press, and most recently for the Washington Post. His latest book, as I say, is 81 Days Below Zero, the incredible survival story of a World War II pilot in Alaska's frozen wilderness. It's available from DeCapo Press, one of our favorite publishers. Brian Murphy, thanks for taking time. Come up to Baltimore to be with us on the show.
Thanks, Dan. My pleasure.
How did you come across this story?
Well, indirectly. Back in 2007, as you mentioned, I was working overseas. I was covering Iraq, and I saw a press release from the Defense Department about the burial of a pilot whose remains were found in Alaska. This was one of the crew members of Leon, and at the bottom of this press release, they mentioned the person who was being buried in Arlington was among four people killed in a crash of the B-24. And they mentioned one survived and managed to walk out of the wilderness after nearly 3 months. And I said, I want to read this book and discover there wasn't one. So I got on it.
Isn't it great the way a story comes to you like that? There's something mentioned almost in passing that strikes you as a wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the tricks of journalism, I guess, to find these things.
So, and when was that, Brian? When did you come across
that? That was in 2007, so quite a while ago.
Okay. But Leon Crane, was Leon Crane alive by then?
No, he died in 2002. I reached out to his family. They were very helpful with providing archival material, some debriefings from the military. They also had a tape that he did near the end of his life as a courtesy to one of the sons of a fellow airman. He discussed his time in Alaska. So we were able to piece it together through that. Another advantage was the crash site is now in a federal preserve, the Yukon Charley Natural Preserve. And that means that it hasn't been picked by treasure hunters and so forth. It's intact.
You mentioned Charley, Yukon Charley, Charley River.
That's
in
right.
Alaska, and Leon Crane. So you didn't have the primary source, but you pieced this together. So this is, you decided, based on that one line in the story about this internment at Arlington, you were going to get the rest of that story.
Yeah, that's right. And it was a bit of a jigsaw puzzle, but the story was so remarkable at the time, it got some attention in the Alaska press. There was a lot of memos between Ladfield and the Pentagon, so there was quite a bit of paper trail to piece it together as well.
Tell us about Leon Crane before the war, before he became an aviator.
Well, he had an interesting academic life. He studied at MIT as a aeronautical engineer. I think part of this was helpful later on because he has a real problem solving mentality. He's not a panicky person, very much an engineering sensibility, and I think this helped him in the wilderness. And as you mentioned, what I also found remarkable is he grew up in West Philadelphia, yeah, right on Baltimore Avenue,
right,
in a row house. He often joked when people talked to him about Alaska that his only previous wilderness experience was a weekend at Boy Scouts at Valley Forge. So I would probably be more equipped to deal with it than him, and I'm certainly not.
A little bit of background about when we get to the year 1943. Of course, U.S. has entered the war in 1941. Aleutian Islands. We should just talk about that a little bit because I don't take anything for granted here anymore about World War II, even Vietnam War or the Iraq War. We're going to talk about Okinawa later in this hour, and I mentioned that island, that name, to a couple of young people today, and they were not familiar with Okinawa. So I don't want to assume that everyone understands what was happening in the Aleutians by the time we get to Leon and Ladfield.
Well, the Japanese staged an invasion of the Aleutian Islands. There's different theories among historians thinking it was a diversionary tactic before the Battle of Midway. Others think this was a effort by the Japanese to gain footholds that they could launch attacks on the West Coast more easily. They occupied two islands for about a year, and it was rough. They never really were able to resupply them well, but these were the only significant battles of World War II fought on what could be called the North American mainland.
Yeah, because actually, Alaska, when did Alaska become a state of the U.S.?
1959, so 50, it was a territory.
Not till 1959, right, okay. So what was Leon's experience in that, if any?
He hadn't been deployed yet to Alaska, but as an interesting side story to the book, and I found this really interesting. The person who was in charge of the search and rescue at Ladfield was also a veteran of the Aleutian campaign. He had remarkable stories about fighting in conditions that were, foggy, windy, just awful. There was one time they mistook a mountaintop for an aircraft carrier. It was that difficult to navigate around. So it was a nice, his experience was a window into just how difficult this footnote of World War II was.
And a note about the plane that Leon and his crew were in. This is a B-24 bomber. They're at Ladd Army Airfield near Fairbanks.
Yeah, that's right. It's the base is still there. It's not called Ladd Field anymore. But the B-24 has an interesting story in its own right. This was a plane that was coming off the assembly line almost one every several hours. They built more than 8,000 of them in a span of about 4 years.
It was in California, I believe, right?
Well, this plane was built in California. They also had a big plant at a Ford, a converted Ford factory in Michigan. They had a few others as well. But this was a plane that is one of the workhorses of World War II. And because it was purpose-built, of course, for war, like so many planes were, as you said, the amenities, if you could even call them amenities, were minimal. I mean, these were planes that were noisy, they were cold, they were hard to fly. I mean, basically, it was a bomb delivery system. And all the pilots who I interviewed who flew in this plane during World War II basically had the same stories about being cold, about being their ears ringing when they got off a mission.
And they certainly weren't insulated for the weather that they could encounter in Yukon territory.
No, not at all. I mean, when Leon bailed out, it was probably at that altitude, it was probably minus 70.
What did you learn about why the plane went down?
Well, the best theory is they were doing something called prop feathering, which is you stop the movement of one prop and then try to manipulate the blade to make it aerodynamic. The point is that if an engine fails, it'll have less drag if the props are not flat against the airstream.
And they were doing that intentionally as part of training?
Yeah. What they were doing out of Ladd Field with not just the B-24 but other planes as well, this was a place where they were doing cold weather testing of planes, thinking perhaps the next war front could be in Norway or Greenland. But the idea was to test these planes in conditions they really weren't built for. So there were lots of crashes, lots of malfunctions, lots of oil gum-ups. What they think happened with Leon's plane is it was in a tight circle of clear air as they were trying to do this prop feathering. Because it was climbing at a steep rate and slow, it may have stalled. And then once it went into the stall, it was impossible to pull it out.
And what do we think the altitude was at that point?
Well, they were trying to reach 25,000 feet. Around 20,000 feet, the instruments began to blink out. As you said, the plane went into a flat spin, which is just as it's described, kind of with the nose down, sort of spinning around. As you said, there was no time even for a mayday call. It appeared that the radio operator might have been spun off his seat by the G-forces. So it was several minutes of huge chaos above the Alaska wilderness.
You know, the story is not set in combat. That's sort of the back theater of the war, isn't it?
Right.
This kind of story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But interesting that this was, as you know, all wars are fought with supply lines and logistics. And this was a really important logistics hub for the overall war. It was the transit point for a program that's called the Lend-Lease program. There were Soviet pilots at Ladd Field, and they were taking American planes, painting over the stars and stripes, putting on the red star, and flying these planes to Siberia to join their war effort on the Eastern Front. So this was an important back channel for a lot of military equipment into the war front.
With only the clothes on his back, Leon Crane's parachute, two boxes of matches, and a Boy Scout knife, he set off on a journey in the dead of winter that tested his skill, perseverance, ingenuity, and his luck. We'll hear more about the Leon Crane story after this break here on Midday as we continue our conversation with Brian Murphy of The Washington Post. His book is 81 Days Below Zero. What a title, 81 Days Below Zero, the incredible survival story of a World War II pilot in Alaska's frozen wilderness. This is Midday, a short break. We'll be right back. I would say it's a story of skill, certainly perseverance, and luck. Luck plays into this a lot. 81 Days Below Zero, the incredible survival story of a World War II pilot named Leon Crane from Philadelphia, who bails out of this B-24. All the members of the crew except Leon die in the crash. These are sub-zero temperatures in Alaska in the Yukon Territory near the Charlie River, right, Brian? Brian Murphy.
That's right, yeah. This area is far eastern Alaska near the border with Canada. When Leon bailed out, they really didn't know their location. They knew the approximate area they were in, but he landed by what is the Charlie River now, but he didn't even know what river it was. He just assumed that since the river was flowing north, he was south of the Yukon, the big Yukon River, where all the tributaries feed into. He had no idea how far away he was from this. He really didn't know where he was.
Was most of the river frozen by then?
It was frozen, but it flows fast enough that he was able to chip through some of the weaker portions, and was able to get water. He made a few attempts at walking overland, thinking he was maybe close to a base, but that didn't work out at all. So his plan was to follow the frozen river to the Yukon, but again, he didn't really know how far that would be.
Two boxes of matches, a Boy Scout knife, the clothes on his back, and it's December 1943.
And it's about minus 50 on the day he bailed out. And you said the clothes on his back. One of the interesting elements was in the haste to put on his parachute, he left his mittens on the plane. So he had no mittens. He had the parachute, of course, which essentially saved his life. He cocooned himself in that every night. You mentioned luck, and we can mention...
Well, the luck part comes in now. So he's out there for a while, and he's walking, right?
That's right, yeah.
And he comes up, he stumbles upon some luck, yeah. He luckily stumbles upon a cabin.
That's right. He, you know, again, getting to his Philadelphia sensibilities or his urban sensibilities, he came across this cabin, which in the tradition of Alaska and other places where there's these type of remote places, it's stocked with provisions. They had a gun there, ammunition, some basic food. But he assumed that this was the edge of a village. He didn't really comprehend the idea that there'd be a cabin with nothing around it for many, many, many miles.
Hunters and trappers would establish a place like that, right?
Right, yep. And this was someone who'd go there in the summer, would do fishing, trapping, just as you said. This was the only one for a long way. He assumed it was on the edge of a village, so he didn't even bother looking for the provisions, really. He found some raisins and a few other things, grabbed a handful. The next morning, set off, thinking there was a village around the bend of the river, but of course there wasn't.
So did he stay in the cabin for a while?
He did. He stayed there for several weeks. His hands were very badly frostbit, and he worked out an ingenious remedy where he melted candle wax on his hands, and that sealed the skin. Was a really elegant solution that he thought up, and he waited until his hands healed. He eventually headed out, but he spent several weeks there, and again, this certainly saved his life.
Brian Murphy, did you go to this area? Did you visit it?
I did, yeah. I visited.
What time of year did you visit it?
Winter. Wanted to get a taste of it.
Okay, so why don't you give us a taste of it? I'm trying to imagine minus 50. I don't have any concept of what that can be like. It's certainly been cold here in Baltimore, and I grew up in Massachusetts, but I don't have any concept of that.
Yeah, and it's a different kind of cold than we're used to here. It doesn't have the humidity, but it doesn't shortchange how incredibly cold it is. I came out of the airport, immediately your nose begins to hurt because the air is so cold and dry. Your teeth hurt. I met a guy on the plane who had no, he was a sled dog enthusiast. He had no eyebrows because he said in the winter they freeze and break off and he waits till spring for them to grow back.
What did Leon Crane do during all that time alone out there?
Well, this was, you know, he, as I said, his personality was very much problem-solving driven, I guess you'd say.
You said he studied engineering, right?
He studied engineering. So his once he just realized that he had to walk out, he dedicated himself to building a harness, a sleigh that he could pack provisions on. He learned how to hunt. He, you know, of course, didn't have much experience hunting. Learned how to hunt game. There's a Arctic bird called a ptarmigan, which is kind of like a grouse or quail. Mm-hmm. He would hunt those. He was kind of a student of the wilderness during these weeks, and he learned the techniques of survival.
Where did it go from there? I don't want you to give away the whole story, but we know that Leon survived. Just can you tell us where he was when he was rescued?
Well, he came across a family who was spent the winter at their cabin. The cabin was not unlike the one that was abandoned, and he came and he found. He was able to get a dog sled team from this cabin to a remote airfield. From there, he was ferried back to Ladfield.
For many years after the war, Leon Crane didn't like to talk about this experience.
No, he didn't. He was a...
Which surprises me a little bit because it's... I mean, of course, he lost his crew, right? But mm-hmm. It's a story of survival. It's not a story of combat. You hear about combat veterans. I interviewed a lot of World War II combat veterans who didn't like to give you details about what they saw, especially in the Pacific. Why was he reluctant to talk about this experience, do you know?
Well, again, I never got a chance to meet him personally, but from his children and friends, I think there was an idea that what he did and what he accomplished was not even worthy of mention in the context of the war, the death, the destruction, the heroism. He was never one to kind of boast about his accomplishments. You couldn't even call it obituary. I mean, he led a very remarkable life, but in the Philadelphia Inquirer, it was only a death notice, no mention of his service, no mention of what he did after the war.
What did he do after the war?
He was involved in aviation. He worked as a aeronautics engineer for a while, and then he got into construction development, kind of building houses around Philadelphia.
You said that at some point he did do a recording for someone who was interested in this experience, who was a relative of a crew member? Or who asked him to do the recording?
Yeah, this was a son of one of, not a crew member, but a son of someone he served with in the Army Air Corps. And even in this, he was asked about his experience in Alaska, and he spoke a little about it, but it was all in very general terms, like it was cold. I never want to go back to Alaska. Very kind of cryptic.
Brian Murphy, who worked for the Associated Press and now the Washington Post, I bet you wish you were there to press him, right?
Absolutely.
I can imagine you're listening to this recording thinking, ask him this, to push him to get a little bit more out of him. But what was it like to hear his voice?
It was fascinating. I mean, once you work on a project like this, you feel a connection, a kinship almost with the subject because you're thinking about him all the time. You're thinking about what he would be doing, why he acted this way, how he responded to different obstacles and problems and so forth. So, it was...
Life is a series of problems to be solved.
Yes, exactly.
Some people look at it that way, and I guess during those 81 days, that's the kind of man it sounds like Leon Crane was.
Yeah.
Because of his training.
I think absolutely. I think this was something that contributed to his ability to walk his way out of the wilderness. There were moments of panic. There were moments of doubt, of course, but I think he remained fixed on the idea that, you know, it was up to him to figure out a way to get out. And of course, he was driven by the idea that everyone presumed he was dead. His family did. The army, even though they don't declare someone dead until 1 year after someone goes missing, there was no search. I mean, it was all believed that he would never come back.
You know, when you hear a story like this, or in your case, actually research the story, write the story, you do personalize it at moments. You think, well, what would I have done? Could I have done this? And since you visited this area of the Yukon, I wonder if you'd asked yourself that question.
Oh, many times. And the answer is usually, I don't think so.
81 days.
81 days.
And as far as you could tell, all below zero, as the title says.
Very much. I mean, they had...
Because it went into January and February, right, mm-hmm. of 44.
Yeah, it was effectively the entire winter season. The plane went down on December 21st, the first day of winter, and he got back to base March 14th, just before the first day of spring.
Your takeaway from the story, Brian?
Again, I think my takeaway is the obvious one. I mean, you cannot give up. Perseverance is the most important trait, I think, that we can apply to any problem. But I think also, as you mentioned earlier, this idea of luck. Sometimes he had the matches on him only because he grabbed them at the last minute because the pilot smoked a pipe and he always was losing his lighter. So he was doing a good deed for someone. Mm-hmm. It came back to be an important element of the story. So this idea that, you know, good fortune can come in many different ways. It might seem a small thing, but it's could be important later.
Here's a thought I had about it. Maybe Leon Crane felt guilty about being the only survivor, and yet he was put through this ordeal in order to survive, to be a survivor.
Yeah, I think there
is. He could have died during that time. So maybe it took the edge off whatever guilt he felt about being the only survivor of the crash.
I think so, but I do think he, like most people, or many people rather, I think there was an element of survivor's guilt, or at least a reticence to be boastful or to sort of give an idea that he was special in some kind of way. This was just his personality.
Brian, thank you for coming up to Baltimore to tell the story. And for the book, folks, if you want to read the whole story, it's 81 Days Below Zero, DeCapo Press, the publisher of Brian Murphy's book, The Incredible Survival Story of a World War II Pilot in Alaska's Frozen Wilderness. And did you have a co-author with this, or someone helped you with this, Brian?
Yeah, my wife, Tula Vlahu.
Oh, your wife. Okay. Yeah. I didn't say that in there. Okay.
she helped with a lot of the research.
Well, thank you very much. It was nice to meet you, Brian.
My pleasure.
And congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Please stay with us, folks. More midday ahead. From the wilderness of Alaska to the Pacific island of Okinawa, a look back 70 years to one of the longest and bloodiest battles of World War II with the help of a man whose dad saw combat there and lived to tell about it. More midday after this. Welcome back, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. On this date in history, June 25th, 1945, the Imperial General Headquarters in Tokyo announced the fall of Okinawa, the island off the coast of Japan, 350 miles off the southernmost coast of Japan, that had been the site of one of the longest and deadliest battles of World War II. The Allied invasion had come on April 1st, 1945, and the battle did not end until June 22nd, 1945. And we note this history this week because we think it's important to look back on this battle that claimed so many lives. We're going to hear about it in this segment of the show. We invited Len Lazarick to join us. Len has been on our show before, well-known here in Maryland, a longtime journalist, the founder, publisher, and editor of MarylandReporter.com, whose dad was in the Army infantry during this long battle of Okinawa. And Len had an opportunity to visit Okinawa, too, in joins us here for this bit of American history. Len, nice to have you back on the show.
Good to be here.
Thank you for making time to talk about this. I was looking at some numbers this week in reading about the Battle of Okinawa, its duration, and the casualties. It's one of those things that takes your breath away the first time you see it. Of course, World War II was an amazing world event. 53 million people, civilian and military, died in World War II. And in this Battle of Okinawa, more than 14,000 American casualties, more than 20,000 Japanese military.
No, actually more like 77,000.
Is it 77,000 of Japanese military?
77,000 Japanese military.
That's different than the number I saw.
And over 140,000 civilians.
Civilians Okinawa.
A third of the population of the island. And a lot of those civilians committed suicide.
Let's go over this. Of course, the U.S. Attacking the Japanese, battling the Japanese in islands. They wanted Okinawa to launch a possible land invasion of Japan, right?
It was considered, it wasn't a home island, but it was considered home base. Iwo Jima had happened only about 6 weeks before this. That was entirely a marine operation and was not an occupied island. Okinawa, I was just looking it up. Maybe I'd looked it up a long time ago. But Okinawa is a little bit larger than Baltimore County. So you put together Baltimore County and Harford County together, and that's the size of Okinawa. And it had about 300,000 people living on it. But most of them were in the south, and that's where most of the battle actually took place. Many thousands of Americans have been there since then because we still have bases there. We have a small army base. We have a very large marine base, and it's been and there's some Air Force component, and that's where a lot of these spy planes from that feed their information to NSA fly along the Chinese coast operate out of. So,
it's been a contention too. The Okinawans don't like the U.S. there anymore, and there's been an effort to reduce our presence there, and yet it still is there. So let's go back to 44 though. The Okinawans, how do they perceive the Japanese? They're distinct from the Japanese, correct?
They are distinct from the Japanese, but they've been under the they were under the control of the Japanese for more than 50 years. They had been an independent kingdom, actually a tributary of the Chinese, but they had their own separate culture. I frankly do not know what language they spoke, but by the 1940s, they were completely made into Japanese. They studied Japanese in school. The cult of the emperor was very important to them.
But they considered themselves occupied during the war because of the presence of the military there, right? It was more than normal, right?
Well, yeah. There was some aspect of that, but they also saw the Japanese military. A lot of the Okinawans were recruited. For instance, during the battles and before the battles, students from Okinawa were recruited, and they graduated from school, and then they were inducted into the military the same day. And so there was this, Japanese culture of the military, and the Japanese saw this as homeland territory. This was there have been a lot of things moving up from Australia through the islands and things like that, and even Iwo Jima, but that wasn't an occupied island. This was considered part of the homeland.
Okay. And I had it as about 350 miles off the southern tip of Japan.
Yeah, Kyushu, the southern island.
Right. Now, so the Americans get there and they invade April 1st around Easter time. Your father...
It was Easter Sunday.
It was Easter Sunday. Your father, Len Lazarick Sr.?
Len Lazarick, yes.
Was a sergeant in the Army.
He got a field promotion on Okinawa. He was a private when he invaded, and he eventually became a sergeant after his first Purple Heart. that he got picking up a Browning automatic machine gun to repel a Japanese invasion. And what you have to understand, most of these guys actually saw Japanese soldiers. This was not happening in the distance. They had direct contact with the Japanese military.
The Japanese were in limestone tunnels on Okinawa.
Right. The entire island is limestone, and they had created a large network of tunnels, and they had decided to defend the southern part of the island, which was, you know, heavily occupied by civilians. And there were civilians in caves, and there were Japanese in caves, and they were also mixed up. So when when I interviewed veterans of this combat, which included Danny Brewster, the former U.S. Senator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a Marine platoon captain in the 1st Marine Division, and he spent the entire time on Okinawa. There were very few people who fought in on the ground, who did not acknowledge that probably they had killed some civilians, either at night because they were not supposed to be moving around, and there was a large propaganda effort on the part of the Japanese to say that the Americans were going to treat the Okinawans the way the Japanese had treated the people in Nanking, for instance. There was going to be rape and murder and pillage, and you know, there haven't been any of these great celebratory movies about this. And it just occurred to me the other day. I've been trying, you know, the more you read about this, including a book I just got recently called Descent into Hell, which is translated from Japanese. These are...
Descent into Hell.
Descent into Hell. And these are civilian memories of the Battle of Okinawa. So it's a very long book of civilians talking about their experience of the war. And there were 300,000 on this island. There was this large propaganda effort, and they just thought that the Americans were going to treat them, but
mistreat them.
Mistreat them, and this did not have the flavor of Europe, where, you know, the French countryside, and we're liberating these people. The folks there did not see these invaders as liberators, and they saw them.
The Japanese were warning them that they would be attacked, raped, killed, right?
Right, right.
By the way, I just want to go over those numbers again. I don't know where I got my number. Your number is correct. Just did some checking here. Japanese casualties, over 100,000 total casualties, 77,000 killed in the Battle of Okinawa over the— how many, 80 days or so of the battle. U.S., 14,000 dead, more than 60,000 casualties. And then we get to the civilians, a much higher number of civilians. And you said, and I've seen this noted, that many committed suicide.
Right. There was organized suicide. And by the way, this is these numbers of dead are graphically presented in this memorial, which was dedicated 20 years ago, and all the names are on the memorial. The governor, Masahiro Ota, who was with the commanders when they committed suicide, established this memorial, and he made a point in an interview at the time with me, we're honoring all the dead. So as far as they could find, all the civilian names, and the civilians included comfort women, Taiwanese forced laborers, the Japanese military, the American military. And at the memorial ceremony, Masahiro refused to have anybody in uniform. So it was a contentious time, but the Japanese military, the American military were allowed to participate, but they had to be in civilian clothes. Hmm.
And you were there. This is 1995. And by the way, Len Lazarick wrote more than one story about the visit there with your father and the other veterans. But at that time, you were working for the Patuxent Papers. You were editor there.
Right, right.
And I put a link to that story on my Facebook page, and it leads you to the other stories that you wrote about it. You mentioned Japanese commanders committing suicide, but the civilians, why did so many civilians commit suicide?
Well, first of all, they were actually encouraged to commit suicide, and they were told, especially as the Americans were progressing south and they were and the Japanese military was being pushed south. And one of the reasons that this memorial is at Mabuni is that there are cliffs over the Pacific, and a lot of people just threw themselves off the cliffs.
Because they believed they were going to be killed anyway by the Americans?
Right. Yeah. And as you know, within Japanese culture, there's a different attitude toward suicide. But it was still suicide. And I was just reading this morning, I hadn't seen this, but organized group suicide as well. But a lot of these people were killed. There was terrific bombardment. There was aerial bombardment. There was sea bombardment. And this is the place where the highest number of Navy people in the entire World War II were killed from the kamikaze attacks. This was the height of the kamikaze attacks. I mean, the Japanese were desperate at this point.
This was this has been described as the last major land battle of World War II. I believe this is correct because it gets us to late June 1944.
Well, the war in Europe,
the war in Europe already ended, is over.
And one of the things, number one, this is far away from the United States. We don't have any experience of this culture. 12 days after the invasion began, Franklin Roosevelt died. This was used by the Japanese as propaganda that the troops would get the thing, oh, your great president Roosevelt has died. Don't you want to give up? And then there was the progress toward Berlin. And
the war in Europe ended while Okinawa was going on.
The war in Europe ended, and this is far, far away, and there weren't many war correspondents.
Just one thing I want to mention. If you look at the calendar then, you get to the end of June, Okinawa, the Japanese surrender Okinawa. Early September, the Japanese surrender. August, the bombs fall.
I'm not sure that there was really any kind of official surrender.
Notice from the Imperial General Headquarters announcing the fall of Okinawa. I guess that's not exactly a surrender.
Right. Well, when the commanding generals, the two commanding generals, commit suicide, they're not surrendering.
Right.
They're admitting defeat.
There was still a plan in case it was needed for an invasion of the mainland of Japan, and the Americans considered this to be the launching point of it, Okinawa.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it's also the horror of this battle really set up the decision to use the atomic bombs. Now, there's some revisionist history that would suggest that atomic bombs were also used to scare the Russians a bit. But I think when you read the overall context, and here we have the new president, Harry Truman, and he's just being told about the bombs, the level of casualties, and they just figured that if we're attacking the home islands, the real home islands, and the civilians are all going to be given pitchforks and whatever against us, that we're going to lose a lot of people, and they're going to lose even more people. And it was part of the calculus of the atomic bomb. People who were on the ships, there were troops on the ships in July who had been there. So it would have been August. Mm-hmm. They were on the troop ships in August preparing for the invasion of the Japanese home islands. And when they heard about the atomic bombs, they cheered. They thought it was great.
You write in the pieces that you wrote 20 years ago, Len Lazarick, visiting Okinawa, that your father, like a lot of veterans, had been reluctant to provide much detail to people who weren't there. The conversations would be about the kind of food they ate and letters from home and different funny experiences they might have had. But they wouldn't actually talk about combat, and you did get your father to talk about that.
Yeah, I think what happens with the older veterans, and you see this across war experiences, that the initial war experience they feel is so close and so terrible that they can't really discuss it. And I saw another figure this morning that what we now call post-traumatic stress
disorder
occurred three times more often on Okinawa than it did anywhere else in the Pacific, because I think really because not only did they see the Japanese directly, but they saw the civilian casualties. I mean, they saw these people who were, you know, who were not wealthy people. They were essentially, you know, a farming economy, and they saw these people being killed, and they're facing these Japanese directly, and some of it is that the Japanese mix themselves, the Japanese soldiers mix themselves,
disguised as civilians, right?
Disguised themselves as civilians. So there was when civilians came out to surrender, there was no trust for them, because some of the Japanese soldiers would actually be, have explosive devices on them that if they got close enough to the troops. So
growing up, your father didn't talk about this.
But later
in life, 20 years ago, you got him to sort of in the, you know, being a journalist.
You
asked your father to tell you more, and he did tell you more.
Right. We were there, and there was still a lot of discussion of the funny things, but they were all ready to share their experiences. My father is still alive. He's 92. Next month, and so he was 72, and they're ready to share these things that has really impacted their whole life. And there was an incident that I wish I could recall better. There was a reception where ex-Japanese soldiers and these American veterans got together for this reception, and all I can remember is how loud and how drunk most of the people were, and it was supposed to be kind of like a symbol of them getting together, but frankly, these American veterans, I mean, a lot of them, the surprising thing was to find a Marine veteran who owned a Japanese car. Most of these people would not.
So at the reception, did they mix together at the reception or not?
No,
they didn't.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, the experience is too close.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lynn, thank you for being here today to talk about this. 70 years ago this week, the end of the last major land battle of World War II, the Battle of Okinawa, that we remember in this special hour of midday devoted to some memories of World War II. And we're looking at the 70th anniversary of the end of the war later in July and August. So we'll have some additional programming then. Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thank you, Aunt Nat. God bless your father. He's 92.
Yep.
Yeah. Len Lazarick Sr. Len Lazarick Jr. is the publisher and editor of Maryland Reporter, MarylandReporter.com. Thank you, Len. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the program. Coming back again tomorrow. We'll see you. Have a great afternoon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.